TCJ Radio International presents Switzerland in Sound, produced and presented by Bob Zanotti.
The hydrogen bomb appears as a probably attainable goal. If successful, radioactive poisoning of the atmosphere and annihilation of any life on Earth has been brought within the range of technical possibilities.
Albert Einstein, speaking in the United States in 1950. It was he, with his famous equation E equals mc squared, or energy is equal to mass multiplied by the square of the speed of light, that made not only the hydrogen bomb possible, but nuclear power plants as well. It also explained how the sun shines. But that earth-shaking equation was formulated here in Bern in 1905 as part of Einstein's first papers on what has come to be known as the special theory of relativity. Another paper described the photoelectric effect, which won him a Nobel Prize. Later in his life, Einstein formulated an equally far-reaching set of ideas, the general theory of relativity. The two are different, and although it would be impossible to explain them comprehensively in this program, we will make an attempt to describe some of the key aspects of them. The reason for all the recent Einstein fever around the world was, of course, the 100th anniversary of Einstein's birth in what is now West Germany on March the 14th, 1879. But he came to Switzerland in 1895. He became a Swiss citizen in 1900, and it was here that relativity was born. Reason enough for hundreds of distinguished scientists from around the world to have gathered in Bern between March 13th and 17th to exchange views on fine points of the complex theories and what current research and experimentation is being conducted which would confirm Einstein's predictions. Let's start with the special theory of relativity, published in 1905 while Einstein was working as an inspector at the Swiss Patent Office. That's the theory which reshaped physics with strange effects seemingly opposed to our everyday perception. For example, nothing can exceed the speed of light. The faster you go, the slower time becomes. The faster you go, the shorter a measuring stick gets. The faster a mass travels, the greater it becomes. And the universe started with a big bang and is expanding all the time. To take up the special relativity story, here's Dr. Alan Held, a Canadian physicist at Bern University and editor of the world's only regular journal on relativity.
Let's take a very, very smooth plane, very smooth plane ride. It's dark and it's night. I would ask you, well, could you tell if the plane was moving? The answer is you couldn't. If you were, for instance, to drop a ball, it would fall straight down, exactly as though you were stationary. And for all intents and purposes, inside this frame of reference, you're not moving. You would have to look outside and see another frame of reference, namely the Earth, and then you would say, ah, I'm moving. But of course, that's a relative statement. You could also say, ah, the Earth is moving. Mm-hmm. Now, the special theory of relativity deals with exactly such frames of references, namely, there is no acceleration, no turning, no spinning. They all have this property that if I were to drop a ball within this frame of reference, it would land at my feet.
Regardless of what it's really doing outside.
The word really doesn't mean anything. That's exactly
it's all relative.
It's all relative. That's exactly the point. That inside this frame of reference, you can't tell anything. That's the rules of the game, in fact. Close the windows on your plane, and there is no way that you could make an experiment which would tell that you're moving with respect to somebody else.
But he added, of course, and quite importantly, a new dimension, the dimension of time. But how can time, which to most of us is abstract, become a dimension? Why is it so important?
We consider the dimensionality of a space as given by the number of coordinates or pieces of information required to determine a point.
In other words, to pinpoint something.
Pinpoint. Let's try this trick. I'll say, Bob, I'll meet you in New York at the corner of 37th and 5th.
Which is the Empire State Building.
Exactly.
But the question is, what floor? There are 102 floors.
Right. So it's obvious that two coordinates aren't enough. I've given you two pieces of information, the intersection of 37th and 5th. Let's say I'll meet you on the 17th floor. Is that enough?
The question is when.
Exactly. So I need to give you a fourth coordinate, a fourth piece of information. I'll say I'll meet you at 5 o'clock on the 3rd of April. So in order to identify this point where we have to meet, let's call it a point in space-time now, I had to give you four pieces of information. Therefore, in order to identify all the points that are of interest to us in physics, we need four pieces of information. Hence, we really live in a four-dimensional manifold, or four-dimensional space-time.
After special relativity, Einstein turned his attention to the question of gravitation. He based his work on the laws of Isaac Newton, up to that time the last word in gravitational truth. But Einstein didn't completely agree with what Newton said. The result? The General Theory of Relativity, published in 1917. Here again is Alan Held.
According to Newtonian law, the orbits of the planets should be ellipses. And they all are, to within the accuracy that we can measure them, with the exception of Mercury. Mercury has a funny property that the orbit rotated itself at the rate of approximately 43 seconds per 100 years.
Now, this doesn't seem like a lot to us, but it's enough to throw off Newton's idea.
That's right. Then Einstein decided to look at the question of gravity and gravitational force, and in the course of this, he was led to essentially the idea of relating gravity to the geometry of the world. Now this relationship of gravity, geometry, and the masses that are in the world or in the universe, this is known as the general theory of relativity. And what he did was essentially redesign the geometry of the world, of the four-dimensional world that we've been speaking of. So he built a curved geometry of space-time. The curvature is caused by the presence of large, massive bodies. He wrote down a set of equations which essentially relates the energy density, which is just another way of saying mass, and perhaps a little bit of heat, all the things that are different forms of energy, to the local geometry. Then, to account for the law of gravitation, that is to say, the force that we started off talking about, he then decided that all bodies in this curved geometry would naturally follow a preferred set of lines called geodesics. Now, what's a geodesic? Well, we all know that when you fly from, say, New York to London, you don't fly on a straight line as we see most of the maps.
You fly what's called the Great Circle.
Right. Now, the Great Circle happens to be a geodesic on a spherical surface. That is, it's a preferred line.
It's not a straight line between the two in a flat plane, but it's shorter in terms of distance.
That's right. But we always project from a three-dimensional space down, and so we don't see that property. Now, he extended this idea to his four-dimensional curved space-time. And he said, I will now assume that bodies in the space-time must follow these preferred curves. It's a little complicated to visualize, but once again, one can work this out mathematically. And if you say these are the equations of motion, you find, for instance, that the path followed by Mercury traces out exactly a slowly rotating ellipse.
In other words, in the case of Mercury, it's actually following the shortest path for it.
In this four-dimensional space-time, that's right.
And he was right on, wasn't he?
Well, he's about as right on as we can measure at the moment.
Dr. Alan Held. Although the general theory of relativity will probably never be completely proved, it serves as the basis for most theoretical physics and is a fundamental part of cosmology, that is, the study of the universe and its origin. By now, most of us have heard of the Big Bang theory of the origin of the universe. Basically, it all started with a mass of infinite density. At the moment of creation, this mass exploded, as it were, throwing matter in all directions. This is the universe, which is still expanding, much like the bits of an exploded bomb. And we're somewhere inside all this mess of debris. But sooner or later, those bits yield to the force of gravity and fall to Earth. In the case of the expanding universe, this compares to what's called the Big Crunch. According to the theory, those bits of matter making up the universe will eventually run out of steam and will start to be pulled back by gravity to that single lump of mass from which they all started. And that will be the end of it. But don't worry, it's not going to happen in our lifetimes. At the Einstein conference here in Bern, I talked with American physicist Professor John Wheeler about the Big Bang and the Big Crunch.
Einstein always argued that the universe should be closed. But one of the most striking consequences of a universe that's closed is this, that such a universe begins with a Big Bang, but it also necessarily ends with a Big Crunch. And there's no before the Big Bang, and there's no after the Big Crunch. It's not as if we're living through a cycle after cycle universe, world without end. Quite the contrary, insofar as we're entitled to believe the evidence, and general relativity has proved itself in every other instance, a marvelous guide to quite unexpected findings. Insofar as we're entitled to believe the evidence of general relativity, we live in a once-only universe.
Professor, could we visualize it like this? We know the child's game of a wooden paddle with an elastic string at the end of which is a rubber ball. And you take this thing and give it a whack. It sails out but is held on by the string, and it inevitably will come back and hit that paddle again. Is that more or less the cycle of the universe we're talking about?
Exactly. That's a very apt analogy. Another analogy is this, a child's rubber toy balloon. The child blows it up, the balloon grows bigger and bigger, but ultimately the child gives up. Let's go, the air rushes out, and the balloon shrinks back to what it was.
But, Professor, there's one thing which bothers everybody, and that is, where are we? What is the universe? What is beyond that, or what is it floating around in?
The concept of a closed space universe might seem, at first sight, to imply that there has to be some larger space in which that curvature takes place. But the great German mathematician Carl Friedrich Gauss, in the early days of the 1800s, wrote that the greatest discovery of his life was the idea, the result, the proof that the concept of curvature could be given a meaning by an ant rushing about on the surface of a rubber balloon without that possibility of that ant ever being able to rise outside the balloon or penetrate to the center of the balloon.
And in short, we wind up in the realm of religion there.
Yes.
Professor John Wheeler talking in Bern. In a manner of speaking, so-called black holes, which have been theorized only relatively recently, are like that original Big Bang mass that started it all off. No one knows for sure what they are, but it's expected that black holes are really burned-out stars, which have such a dense mass that their gravitational pull is tremendous. In fact, their presence and number in the universe might play a role in determining the validity of the Big Crunch idea. Here's cosmologist Professor D.W. Sharma of Britain.
A black hole is an object so compact for its mass that the gravity on its surface is so great that not even light can leave the surface. So if we looked at such an object, we'd get no signals from it, either in the form of light or material particles. We're very excited at the moment because there's an X-ray source in the constellation Cygnus, which we think is very likely an example of a black hole. The idea being it's got a companion star, which is a visible star, that it captures the outer material, the outer envelope of that star, and as it's captured and squeezed in and eventually goes down the black hole, before it's gone down the drain, as it were, it gets so hot by being squeezed, say 10 million degrees, that it emits a copious flood of X-rays. And these X-rays can be detected at the Earth before they're caught by the black hole. Of course, we work the other way around. That is, we see X-rays, and we infer by model building that the best explanation is that there is a black hole responsible. We're not quite sure, but it's very likely.
I suppose one of the questions in everyone's mind or imagination is what's on the other end of it or what's inside it.
If you fell into a black hole, say with the mass of the sun, then as soon as you crossed its surface, the point inside which no light rays can emerge, then in 100,000th of a second, you would be dragged into the central reaches of the black hole, which have an infinite density, just as the Big Bang origin of the universe does. So to that extent, there is a slight analogy. So my general advice is keep away from them.
Professor D.W. Sharma, because of the great impact that Einstein's theories have on our concept of the structure of the universe, it's understandable that the majority of the speakers at the Berne conference dealt with cosmological matters. One man on the edge of cosmology is Swiss physicist Professor Johannes Geiss of Bern University. It was his solar wind experiments, carried to the moon by American astronauts, that gave Professor Geiss a renewed interest in Einstein's ideas.
The solar wind experiment you mentioned, which I did here with my colleagues, had something to do and got me personally involved to some extent in cosmological questions, and that is connected with this whole question of where does the heavy hydrogen come from? Deuterium, it's another name for it, and there is the idea, although this is still a matter of debate, that this heavy hydrogen in fact comes from the early hot dense part, stage of the universe.
And it's just after the Big Bang.
Right. It's made in the Big Bang at about 100 seconds into the expansion, to use a NASA slogan, into the flight. And if that's true, that of course connects this experiment, which is kind of nice to think of, with one of these fundamental questions. And from there on, I dealt more with Einstein's theories. Although I would not say I doubted them before, they have become much more real for me now.
Professor Johannes Geiss, the special theory of relativity is considered a proven everyday fact in science. The general theory looks pretty good and has many adherents, most of whom are convinced it's right too. But a third major idea put forth by Einstein, that is, his unified field theory, is another matter. Basically, Einstein was searching until the time he died for a set of equations which would unify all forces in the physical universe. He was trying hardest to show that gravitational and electromagnetic forces had one and the same basis. He never proved it. But recent research has been revealing signs that he might well have been right, and that at least some proof of this unity may be only a matter of time. One of those holding that view is the Nobel Physics Prize winner, Professor Chan-Ning Yang of the United States. What impact would proof of Einstein's unified field theory have on physics?
It was great impact on fundamental physics because it aims at understanding the fundamental structure of matter. Matter, in simple terms, consists of constituent particles, the so-called elementary particles, and the forces between them. In a final grand unification of interactions, we would presumably also understand the unification of matter or of the elementary particles together with these forces. If we can reach such a stage, I would say that we would have a rather deep understanding, much deeper than today's, of the fundamental structure of matter. That, of course, would be a great revolution in fundamental physics. But I would go beyond that. If we do understand the fundamental structure of matter, it is very difficult to imagine that we would not be able to turn that knowledge into practical purposes. Nobody at this moment is able to predict precisely how one is going to use the new insight gained from a unified theory of all the interactions and matter. But based on past experience, it is safe to predict that there will be important uses.
Professor Chen Ning Yang. Einstein was a genius. There's no disputing it. But what was it that gave him his tremendous powers of concentration, such enormous ability to solve incredibly abstract and complicated problems? Einstein came to Switzerland in 1895. He studied at the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology in Zurich until 1900. He then took an undistinguished job at the Swiss Patent Office in Bern a year later. He worked there as an inspector, and it was during this time that he enjoyed the most productive scientific days of his career, leading to the special theory of relativity in 1905. Professor John Wheeler of the United States is convinced that it was the job in the Swiss Patent Office itself that played no small role in developing Einstein's tremendous abilities.
Every day he had this quota of patent applications in front of him that he had to inspect. And those were the days when a patent application was accompanied by a working model. But over and above the patent applications and the working model, there was the boss, Friedrich Haller. Haller gave strict instructions that one was to explain in just a few words, if possible in a single sentence, why the device would work or why it would not work, why the application should be granted or why it should be denied. And here was Einstein with this task, day after day, to distill the central point out of the most complicated devices that the mind of man has power to invent. A unique training to enter into ideas not his own and extort the simple central point out of it all from the clutter of facts. Einstein liked to take his visitor, when he was patent office clerk in Bern, to go and watch the bears go round and round in the bear pit. And the bears would go around on all fours with their head to the ground. Only very rarely, now and again, would one bear rear up on its hind legs and look around. Einstein said, "That bear is the thinker."
That was Professor John Wheeler of the United States. There is no irrational hero-worshipping cult surrounding Albert Einstein. He's revered in science as an outstanding member of that fraternity because of the magnitude of the impact of his contributions to literally reshaping our ideas about physics and the universe. Certainly, he has left his mark. But for how long? Is it likely that there will be another physicist of the stature of Albert Einstein? Professor Leon Vanhove, director of CERN, the European Nuclear Research Center in Geneva, which couldn't function without Einstein's theories.
Well, maybe there will, maybe there will not, I cannot say. What I could say, however, is that if you look at history of science, you have indeed to go back more than a century. In fact, you have to go back to the 17th century with Isaac Newton, Galileo Galilei, before you find in history people of that quality and of that scope. So my answer would be, maybe there will be others, but not many.
And with the 20th century almost running out, I guess it's almost safe enough to say that he was indeed the scientist of this century.
There is no doubt on that.
Professor Leon Vanhove. And finally, Professor Chen Ning Yang.
As a scientist, Einstein was incomparably original. He was daring, and he dared to think the unthinkable in a way which is truly remarkable.